Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me for another really important conversation that I will be having today with my very special and amazing guest. I just want to say that if you're listening for the very first time or if you've been tuning in for a while, that this show is dedicated to empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. And that theme of the show, the purpose of the show, is really highlighted with my conversation today with my guest. And I'm just going to jump right into things because we have so much to talk about, and I'm just so honored that we have time with Dr. Marilyn Singleton today. And I'm going to start off by introducing you to her, and then we will have an enlightening and empowering and, I trust, a call to action to everyone listening today. So Dr. Singleton is a board-certified anesthesiologist and past president of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. She graduated from Stanford and earned her MD at UCSF Medical School. Dr. Singleton completed 2 years of surgery residency at the University of California at San Francisco Medical Center, and then her anesthesia residency at Harvard's Beth Israel Hospital. She was on the faculty of Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland, before returning to California for private practice at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles and Altabates Medical Center in Berkeley. While still working in the operating room, she attended UC Berkeley Law School. She interned at the National Health Law Project and practiced insurance and health law. Along with delivering medical and educational supplies, she started 2 makeshift medical clinics in 2 rural villages in El Salvador. And she's even made time to be with us today. And I am so honored and grateful to have Dr. Marilyn Singleton, who is going to really help us understand and wake up to what's going on in the present moment with the COVID, with vaccines, with our freedoms, with so much of what we need to be aware of at this monumental moment in history, I would call it. So, Dr. Marilyn Singleton, thank you for being with us today, and welcome to What Women Must Know.
I am honored to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, you're amazing women. You have just dedicated so much of your life to gaining knowledge, education, skills, resources to serve and help people really throughout the world. I just want to, before we get into the situation that we're going to talk about with everything happening in our world, I'm really curious as to what was the impetus? What drove you to this direction in your life to commit so much of your life to healing and truth and justice?
Honestly, I think it was having good parents. I feel so lucky and blessed that I had wonderful parents. That growing up, my mother had this expression that she always told us. She'd say, "You never have to take low to anybody, and you can be whatever you want, you can do whatever you want, and never let anybody tell you anything differently." And that's pretty much what we've lived by. My parents always did things to help others out, and it's not like we were just a bunch of goody-two-shoes, but that's just sort of how our family was. And I have to say, it just seemed to come easy, because I think it's easy to follow how you were raised. If you get a good role model, then you're pretty much set for life.
And especially that message that you can be whatever you want to be. You know, I recently heard someone talking, and they go, you know, "We've been told sky's the limit. But they said, it's actually the sky is limitless. There is no limit. There is no sky. What is limitless is our imagination. And when we can imagine in those unlimited ways, we can achieve And, you know, I found that inspiring. And, you know, obviously it's what you embraced in your life.
It's interesting to me that I think back to my mother, rest her soul, that I started school in kindergarten when I was 3 because my birthday is at the end of December. And my mother went to put me in public school and they said, oh, well, she has to be 4 in September and she's not, so she can't go. Well, my mother is never one to take no for an answer, and she marched us down to the Catholic school down the street, and they said if she's toilet trained, she can start school. And I remember that, and it was one of those things that was such a good lesson to see that, no, you don't take no for an answer. And when I applied to college, my high school counselor, not that she was a mean, awful woman, but she was trying to keep me from being disappointed, she said, well, you know, they don't take Negroes at Stanford. And my father said, screw them. You're, apply anyway and see what happens.
Well, yes. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, yeah. This idea, you can't ever buy into, no, I can't do it, and I'll be a victim and maybe someone else will help me. It's like, no, help yourself.
And then what made you go into law? Because you've had such, you know, thorough training, and you've gone to all the residencies and gone on and learned all these other facets of your field in medicine. And then you went on to UC Berkeley Law School while you're still operating in the theater. What was that about? Why did you make that decision? Because that seems like an awful load to put on oneself.
Well, I'll have to say something quite honestly. When you go to law school, when you're an older person who's lived life, it's much easier than when you're 21 years old and don't know anything about life. A lot of it is logic and figuring things out. Yes, you have to learn about some cases and all, but so much of it is common sense that when you're older, you have a bit more common sense than your average 21-year-old. I'll tell you what sent me there was the pitch for socialized medicine. When Hillary Clinton's health plan came out and it was clear that it was trying to get rid of private practice of medicine, which I'm a firm believer in, that patients need their individual doctor and doctors need to be able to give individualized care in order to give the best care. And reading this, it just looks like this is chipping away. So I just didn't want to be somebody who didn't know what they were talking about. And I thought, well, if I get into Berkeley Law School, then I was meant to go, and I did, and learned constitutional law and administrative law so I could get a feel for when they pop out with these dicta and you think, wait a minute, you can't do that, that they're just saying things to try to get people to believe that it's constitutional or legal when it actually isn't. So I was glad I did that. I still always practice medicine, and because that is my first love, but I did want to know what I was doing and what I was talking about. So I did it.
Well, you know, that seems to be incredibly relevant these days, because as a physician, you have the training and understanding of what is really contributing to health or what is not contributing to our health, and, you know, the messages that are coming out these days. But then as a lawyer, you bring in the constitutionality part of what is happening, and you get a much bigger picture of where we are off the rails, right, you know, or where we are potentially on the rails. But you can see in a much greater scope of whether we are being told the truth or whether we're being lied to, from the point of view of what we need to do for our health and also what our rights are.
Yes, and understanding about rights. One of the things that I hear people say, oh, it's my right to do such and so, and I have to remind them that the Constitution is talking about the government. It's talking about the state and what the state cannot do to you. And it's a whole nother ballgame when you talk about private businesses. Some private businesses are so broad, things like hospitals, that they're treated as though they're the state, like they can't discriminate and whatnot, all the things that a state couldn't do against you. But smaller private businesses, unless there's some specific law, and that's why most anti-discrimination laws are written into the law, they can do whatever they want. And this has come up with all this COVID stuff and wearing masks and people saying, well, they can't force me. It's a private business. They can ask you to do whatever they want. And the government may not be able to do that. But this is something that we're starting to see now. And the government knows that some of the things they've said is unconstitutional. In fact, Wisconsin, the governor's mask mandate was overturned because it was beyond his powers. That they're trying to pull the private businesses in and making them do it. And then where will we be? How many businesses can you not go to because you say, I don't want to wear the mask, or I don't want to get a vaccination, and I don't want to have to show a passport in order to go to the grocery store? Are we going to be like the dystopian movies where they have the free zones where all the free people can go? It's like across the line of pine trees, and suddenly you're in the free zone. And it could be a whole new cottage industry, businesses that allow you to come in without a mask or without a vaccine passport. Who knows where that's going?
Well, let's talk first about this vaccine issue, because that's just so controversial, right? I mean, and the fact that there is, a $1.4 billion advertising campaign going on, funded by the government to address people's concerns. But are people's concerns valid from your perspective, Marilyn?
Certainly. All I want to say, and I'm trying to look at facts and make conclusions from things that are reported in major government sites, and there's the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. And so far, it's up to about 51,000 cases where there's significant adverse outcomes, and including death, which is about, over the last 10 years with other vaccines, we're seeing in the few months that these new vaccines, if you want to call them that, I mean, technically they aren't vaccines because they don't keep you from getting the disease, but we're seeing many more of these adverse events. Now, it could be because more are being reported, because people are more aware, but generally speaking, many adverse events are not reported to the government. So we really don't know how many there are, but certainly by reports, we've had this over 50,000 with about 2,500 deaths. Maybe, it's about 5% of all the adverse events. I think people should know this. I'm not against vaccines in general. These vaccines are still considered experimental. They're under emergency use authorization. They are not fully approved by the FDA, only for emergency use. So right now, people are on solid ground to say, no, it's only under emergency use. And by law, you can't force somebody to take a drug that's under emergency use. And people can bring that up and make who's ever forcing you to have it have to go back and look at the law. Now, this is why I mentioned the difference in this private versus public, because, you know, employers may tell you you have to have a vaccine. What, at the very least, people need to get informed consent. And this is something that's been lacking in the whole vaccination sphere anyway, where it's just assumed everything is so benign, you'll just walk in the office, get a shot, or walk in to the drugstore, get a shot, and go home. I think everybody should be given informed consent and be read the Riot Act before they get anything. Most people will still go ahead and get it for whatever their reasons are, but people ought to know. And the idea that movie stars come on TV and show themselves getting a shot, that's not medicine. Who are they? They're some person in show business that, to me, what would be more realistic would be have a doctor sit there and say the pros and cons, and the pros and cons for each individual patient, but that's never going to happen.
So first of all, we're using that term vaccine, but there's so much controversy about that term as being an inaccurate term with what is being given to people. The fact that it is considered an experimental technology that doesn't fit the criteria for a vaccine. What are your thoughts on that?
Right, and I think most people believe that it is not a vaccine with the technical definition of a vaccine. A vaccine prevents the recipient of the vaccine from getting the disease. The antigen, that signature protein that makes your body make antibodies, stops it in its tracks. That's not the case. We kind of were trying to find what the right word would be to call these biological agents. Something. They're not really treatments. You might call it a treatment. But it does not keep you from getting the disease of COVID-19. What the vaccine manufacturers, this isn't me making this up, right in their literature, the ones that are on the market now, Johnson & Johnson, for the United States, we have Johnson & Johnson, Moderna, and Pfizer, that their literature says that what it's effective at is preventing severe or moderate disease. So you may get a mild case of COVID, which is fine. If it keeps you from dying, okay. But let's be honest about what it is. When you get a measles shot, you don't get a mild case of measles. You don't get measles. So it's not truly a vaccine. And again, these folks have admitted that what it's these so-called vaccines are trying to do is tame the problem and just sort of let a little air out of the problem. And it's supposed to free up the hospital beds, et cetera. Well, the hospital beds already are freed up. And there's ICU beds. Not that we want anyone to go to the ICU. Not that we want anyone to die. So in that sense, it would be a good thing. But the problem is, we can't treat all patients the same. It's been known for months that there's kind of a tier of what happens with COVID patients. If you're 0 to 9 years old, it's rare to die. It's uncommon to get sick. And even the CDC has shown that the kids are not transmitters. And then you go all the way up to the people who are over 80, And that's the bulk of the people who've died. And these folks who are over 80, they're already over what the technical lifespan in the United States, it's 78 and a half years about, that is the average lifespan. So these folks are quite old. Why weren't we protecting the old folks? Why weren't they the ones who were getting the vaccine first if that's who we're trying to keep from dying? So that was a little screwy that they weren't first on the list. In fact, in my area, it was like the third group of people down were the older folks, yet they were the ones who were getting sick from COVID. When younger people got it, they tended not to be sick. Now, of course, there's always going to be a news story about the healthy 38-year-old bicycle rider who got COVID and died in 3 days. But there's always a story like that. But if you take all the people as a whole, it's the older folks who got sick and who died, with occasionally younger folks getting sick and dying. So we have to look at how you deal with the illness in this sort of tiered system rather than just blanket say, all right, everybody do this. Because if you look at the risk benefit, if you're a young, healthy person who's highly unlikely to get COVID disease in the first place, then why would you get vaccinated? So an older person who's very, very likely, and let me clarify, when I say COVID disease, that's what COVID is actually getting sick. The virus that causes COVID is called the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So many people can test positive for the virus, but they aren't a case of COVID disease. So they're two different things. And one of the things that started to scare people into thinking they should race out and get a vaccine without weighing the risk and benefits is they were always told every positive test was a case. But technically, again, a case is the disease, not just testing positive for having a virus in your system. And indeed, the test they were using was testing fragments of RNA. So you might have just had a dead fragment of RNA and not even had an active case. Some of my colleagues and I were talking about this. If we just randomly started testing people on the street for various viruses, I'm sure many people would test positive, but they're perfectly healthy. And so people just need to see that difference, that COVID-19 is the disease that arises from the SARS-CoV-2 virus.
So, gosh, there's so many things to unravel. I feel like we're unraveling this knot, right? So, one of the things we have to unravel is that having a positive PCR test, which is the most common way it's been used, does not mean, number one, that you even have a virus, because that's a flawed test. And then even if it was accurate that you came up positive, it doesn't mean that you have an active disease going on that is showing symptoms at all, which just means that you have an active immune system that is addressing an issue going on with the virus. So, and then when people talk about cases, which they talk about all over the place, right, they bring all these statistics up on cases. Cases aren't necessarily, they don't mean active, in people showing up with an active infection of the COVID-19, right? Do I have that right, Marilyn?
Right, right. You explain that very well.
Because we don't understand these terms, a lot has come to light about the PCR tests, how they designed them to run in such a way that everyone could be seen as being positive because they've just, done it to an excess to show any kind of virus.
So we've been given false testing and false languaging that has led people to be in this state of tremendous fear, which then moves them into whatever direction the narrative wants them to go.
You're absolutely right. And all the linguists and rhetoric teachers and whatnot say words matter. And it was really so disingenuous the way the words were used, and even looking at the optics of these columns that were put up on newscasts where they would have, I'll say, quote-unquote cases, and then deaths would be in larger font. And it was so obvious when you're looking for it that it was like what was in the 60s, subliminal messaging, where they were just trying to flash this in front of your eyes to get people to see things in a certain way rather than to look at the whole picture. And we're smart people. We all deserve to see the whole picture, not just what someone wants to shove down our throat.
So Marilyn, you're a physician, you're a surgeon. There have been many physicians, surgeons, specialists, doctors all over the world who are supporting this narrative and supporting the use of this experimental biological device. I don't understand what's happened. You know, you have the ability to seek for truth. And I totally respect you, and I'm so grateful that you not only have that integrity to speak for truth, but you're willing to speak out for truth. What do you think? This is what perplexes me. What do you think has happened to all those other doctors and lawyers that have supported this hysteria? And promotion?
Certainly in the United States, and I chatted with some folks in certain other countries, there's a lot of pressure, and people feel job pressure. And interestingly, like with so many issues, there's all these other tentacles that feed in to what create a major problem several years down the line. And one of the things that started several years ago was this consolidation of medicine, getting away from private practice. Now only 47% of doctors are in private practice, and many of them are now employees of medical systems. So you see what I'm getting at here. If you're an employee of one of these huge hospital systems, you have to toe the party line. And there have been plenty of doctors who have tried to break away. Some have lost their positions. There was a fellow in Northern California who, he wasn't fired off the staff, but he lost his position that he had as a directorship because he had voiced loudly concerns about the lockdowns and that they were not efficacious and that they were doing more harm than good. So it's real what's happening to people who speak out. And if you're in the position where you're not beholden to anyone, it certainly makes it easier to speak out. And then other people have had their reputations sullied, that people with Twitter and Facebook and all this stuff, that where they've had their accounts removed and then say, this account has misleading information with no explanation. I had written a very long piece called Mask Facts, and all it was curating studies with the conclusion written straight from the study, not something I made up. And I had pros, I had cons, and some conclusions, quote, from the World Health Organization. And someone went to posted on Facebook, and Facebook said this has misinformation. So I questioned Facebook and said, no, it doesn't. They said, well, you put a quote in from the World Health Organization from last April, and they changed their mind in August. And I wrote back and said, that's why I put both quotes in, so you could compare their positions. And then what did they tell me? Oh, the 7 days is up that you have to appeal. So clearly, they just didn't want it posted. And so this is happening when you've got, I consider Facebook and Twitter are de facto newspapers, because that's what people look at. And since they have a narrative that they want to push, they will make sure other voices are silenced.
Okay, so here's the big question, Marilyn. What is the real narrative that this is all leading to, in your opinion, your experience?
And from what I'm seeing, it's a chance on certainly a more worldwide basis to give governments more control over the people. That people tend to have a libertarian streak and want to be individuals and want to seek their individual liberties. And I don't know if too many people are jumping off the reservation or because there's bigger plans. When you look at this so-called Great Reset, that it's not a secret. I mean, there's articles written about it, the people behind it write about it, and that they feel that there's a way to have a better world. And that's their opinion, that going into a world where the government controls more behavior is better. Personally, I do not think that's better. Personally, if you read history, you find where too much government control does not improve the lives of people. So where do we go from here? We have to get individuals to speak out, to maintain their own individuality and say, no, the government can't tell me what to do. I mean, we went through this phase, the 60s, 70s, 80s, was very much our bodies, ourselves phase of thinking about our health and medicine. And then it gradually has drifted away when the government offers you more goodies, free health care, free this, free college, free that, universal basic income, and you don't think about what you have to give up to get something free. There is no free lunch. And unfortunately, by the time people figure it out, it's too late. It then becomes hard to go back once some of these rules and laws are in place. Look at what happened after 9/11, that the Patriot Act, it kind of went too far. Yes, of course we wanted to look out for the country and find ways to find terrorists and whatnot. But then people started using it for wrong reasons. And this is right now, as a physician, I just can't cotton to the idea that our health is being used as a tool to groom us, really, for having the government tell us what to do.
Yeah, well, you know, this is such a pivotal moment in history. I think it's so overwhelming for people to even think that we are in such a massive time of change that could profoundly limit our freedoms as never before. And I want to ask you, as a lawyer, having experience, what are our rights right now? What are our rights if we don't want to take the vaccine, if we don't want to have a passport or identity card, or if we don't want to wear masks? What are our rights? Do we have any left?
Well, this is what's interesting, certainly, about the Bill of Rights. Now, we can go back and realize that the Bill of Rights came about because we do have natural rights, rights we were born with that presumably no one can take away. But being part of a civil society, there's certain rights that have to be balanced against a greater need. How vaccines were mandated all the way back in 1905 was for the good of public health. At the time, smallpox, that's what the vaccine was, had no treatment. So you could look at it, a vaccine was the only way to quell the smallpox, and which did kill people. Smallpox is a terrible disease. Fortunately, it's eradicated. Now, arguably, and I'm sure this is going to come up, we can honestly say that reading the language of the Supreme Court case that said you could force somebody to get a vaccine is, it said that there was no other treatment. We have treatments for COVID. We have multiple treatments for COVID, early treatment. And this is where it seems to get kind of nefarious, because people who talk about early treatment are silenced. Early treatment with some very cheap drugs. Some of the drugs cost more than others. Some are very cheap. They're finding this one antidepressant, fluvoxamine, has been working very well. But you have to treat it early. Inhaled steroids, like people use for asthma, they're finding works really well. But you've got to give it to people early. And they did all these studies to try to debunk it. And then you look at who the patients were in the studies. They were people in the ICU. They were already severely ill. So, no. And then, as physicians, we say, what disease do you wait until you're in the ICU to treat? Nothing. Do you wait to treat high blood pressure till after someone has a stroke or a heart attack? Of course not. Well, we need to treat COVID the same way when you're exhibiting the symptoms. And now they have these 15-minute tests. Some people say, well, how do you know they have COVID? Well, do a 15-minute test. And they're very plentiful now. So there is no excuse not to treat early now.
Well, what is that test?
Well, there's several brands. And I know at two of my local drugstores, they give a 15-minute COVID test. And there's pop-up tents. Now, I live in a metropolitan area, so certainly I don't know that everybody has this advantage, but they have pop-up tests for instant COVID tests. And, you know, so there's multiple brands. And when all this testing was coming out, I think there was something like 60-some-odd, or it could have even been over 100 people were developing COVID tests. And then bit by bit, the FDA started approving them. But there's quite a few out there.
So will that show you that you actually have an active infection that is, you know, overwhelming your immune system, or will it show that you just have some antibodies showing up that your body is dealing with on its own effectively?
Well, you can take either test. Interestingly, they're starting to do the 15-minute antibody test. They didn't early on. This is probably going on for about a month. CVS drugstore chain is announcing that in their minute clinics, they're going to do the 15-minute antibody test, which to me is pretty useful just as far as helping you make the decision if you want to get the vaccine. You might decide, well, do I need a vaccine? I've already had the disease. I'll have my natural antibodies. And that's one road to take. If you're acutely ill or you start to get the sniffles, whatever, and think you might have an active case, then you'd get unfortunately, the PCR test. And if I went in to get a PCR test, I would ask the people administering the test, is this the new way to do it or the old way? If they give you a blank stare, then you explain to them that the old way, and you don't have to know the science behind it, was 40 cycles. The new way that Dr. Fauci, St. Anthony himself, has said that it should not be over 30 cycles, because it's kind of opposite than what you intuitively might think. The more cycles you go through on this, the more it starts to pick up just dead pieces of RNA and not active virus, and just find out. So there's the two kinds, the antibody test. And you'll know the difference, because the antibody test, they do a finger prick and take a drop of blood and put it in a little dish type thing, almost like a home pregnancy test. And then there's little lines that read it, and it'll say what kind of immediate antibodies. Now, those tests that you can get at the drugstore, they don't test. I know this is getting complicated. They don't test for T-cell antibodies. And what T-cell antibodies are is they're the really long-lasting antibodies. In fact, somebody had written up that they found positive antibodies to the 1918 flu in a 90-plus-year-old person. So that's how long T-cell antibodies last. And that is a bigger test, and you're not going to get that at the corner store. And but as far as the antibodies that last for a few weeks to a couple of months, that those tests are readily available now.
Okay, that's good. You know, it's important to know that there are tests that are rapid and more accurate than PCR tests. Wow. So let's talk a bit about children in schools, because that's something that you're really concerned about as well. What's happened to this narrative that has kept kids out of school or kept them masked while they're in school? You know, it's taken to the level of absurdity. I just read somewhere that in Spain they're mandating that people wear a mask when they're swimming.
I read that. I can't imagine. I read that, and I tell you, someone is going to drown if they're foolish enough to try to follow that advice. I was stunned.
Unbelievable. And I have to tell you, I am here in Queensland, Australia. So Queensland had 6 deaths from COVID. And I think they've had last year 240 deaths from the flu, but 6 deaths from COVID. And they have found a couple of cases. They never really explain when this information goes out over the news. If, you know, when they say there have been cases, again, in the distinctions we've been making, is that an active infection or is that someone who's been shown to be positive of their PCR test? We don't know. But so they had maybe 10 cases show up in Brisbane. Now, Queensland is bigger than probably the state of Texas. And the government here mandated that people throughout the entire state of Queensland wear masks I think that's going to go on for almost a month. And because of the few cases in Brisbane, thousands of miles. I mean, I'm an hour and a half north of Brisbane. There's never been anything up here. The whole entire state has been mandated with a $13,000 fine. And you know what's interesting, Marilyn? They require, you know, if you're going to side businesses, you have to have a mask. You have to wear a mask if you're going into your gym unless you do exertive exercise. I mean, I can't imagine anyone going to a gym and not doing exertive exercise, but I've seen people in my gym with their masks on. And I see just people wandering around the streets with their mask on, and it is not mandated here. And there is no infection, no COVID, no cases here in most of the entire state. And there you see people outside, kids outside, masked up, the whole thing. It's like, it's so sad because I feel like
it is sad.
People have just been brainwashed into behaviors, you know, irrational.
Absolutely. And when you're by yourself, my goodness, again, if you look at the data, the common sense, that the breezier it is, if you're out in moving air, you're not going to get virus. It's diluted. It's an aerosol anyway. So, yes, it's out there. It's in the ether. It's in the world. But out in fresh air, moving, walking, unless somebody walks up to you and sneezes into your face, there's no reason to have a mask on. It was a complete behavior change.
It's insane. And I wanted to say one other thing about someone sneezing in you. Today I read, there was on one of my emails, there was a doctor in the U.S. who is outspoken, and he's saying COVID is a vitamin D deficiency condition. And if you build up your vitamin D, it's one of the most important things you can do to strengthen your immune system to deal with any adverse exposure to anything. Again, we get so frightened, right? But if we keep our immune system strong, if you can do only one thing and check your vitamin D levels and make sure it's in the upper end of that range, you're doing an amazing thing to strengthen your immune system.
It's interesting you bring that up. That's Dr. Ryan Cole. He's a pathologist in Idaho, and he's been trying to get the word out, and it's very interesting. And I had written in another article when people were talking about brown-skinned people having more COVID, and, of course, brown-skinned people have lower vitamin D levels because your natural absorption of vitamin D is dependent on skin color. The fairer you are in skin color, the more vitamin D you absorb. And so this was something that people knew fairly early on. There's several simple personal health things one could do to try to keep themselves healthy. And it bothered me no end, and I'm no nutritionist, that we weren't hearing that in the news. All we heard was, you're going to die, you're going to die, you're going to die. And then nobody said, well, here, why don't you start perking your body up? Early on, we knew being fat was not a good thing, that almost everyone in the ICU with COVID was fat. So somehow it became politically incorrect to say the word fat, so I said it. And people who were quite obese generally were way up there on the scale of likely to die. That age, high blood pressure. And so right away, people should have been improving their diets. People should have been told about zinc. Now, people have heard of it because they had zinc lozenges for colds. And so it should have been more explained. Yes, zinc does help stop viruses from replicating, and that's what makes you sick. We all have viruses, but our own natural immune system keeps them at bay. It keeps them from burrowing in and taking over the cell's machinery and then just overwhelming the cell, and eventually the cell's going to die, and it just becomes this virus factory. But that's the point of being healthy. And no one ever told us this. Take your vitamin C and D. And no, these things aren't going to be a cure-all, but don't you want to start from the best level possible? And these are things that anybody can do. These are cheap vitamins, and it bothers me so much. They're spending so much money on a lot of other stuff. Why not just give every human being in your country a packet of vitamins, and they might be better off? And one of the things that was bothering so many people when this whole thing began, was closing gyms down, not even letting them put their equipment outside. Gyms are what people needed. And now they're saying, if there's anything you could do for yourself to improve your health, what is it? Exercise. And that's what they shut down.
Well, so we have just a few minutes, but I do want you to touch on schools and kids and what's the truth about sending our kids back to in-class learning.
Okay. The CDC has a really good study that came out of Mississippi, because Mississippi didn't shut down schools forever and ever. And they looked at several thousand children and kids in daycare and found it was not associated with having positive SARS tests. So it's a mystery as to why, as soon as that came out, every school in this country was not open. There was a lot of, in my state, a lot of union pushback and asking for more and more things, pay raises and whatnot, that the CDC several months ago had put out recommendations for how schools could be opened, and certain ventilation changes and cleaning rooms with UV light and these plexiglass shields and even now that's changed, because they said keep the kids 6 feet apart, and now they're saying all they need to be is 3 feet apart. And apparently 3 feet had been the number all along, but somebody miscalculated because the initial number came out in meters. So they miscalculated. And true story. So and the thing is, some of this stuff doesn't make sense, in that if it's kind of been shown, okay, the viruses can be particles in the air, and they've done experiments where somebody sneezes or coughs rather forcefully, and that can travel 27 feet. Well, obviously they're not going to tell us to say stay 27 feet apart. So it almost becomes an all or none phenomenon. We're not going to stay 27 feet apart. So you might as well let us get these little microdoses. And unless you're in the high risk group, diabetes, obesity, age, go ahead, get healthy and live your life. It sounds simplistic, but sometimes simple things are simple. And yes, even if you do all that, you may get sick. I mean, Adele Davis, who was the big vegetarian, got colon cancer. These things happen. So, you know, nothing is foolproof, but we can do the best that we can do. And I feel the government should have been telling us this rather than trying to scare us half to death, that there was nothing we could do other than stay home, curl up in a little ball, and wait to die.
Well, I am so grateful that there are people like you, Marilyn, who have the courage and the integrity and the determination to speak the truth, to share the truth. It's really hard to challenge you on your credentials and the authority that you have from your, accumulated degrees in medicine and law. You are such a voice of truth and reason and sanity, which is what we need, and also offering us solutions to move through this time. And if there's one thing that makes us vulnerable amongst all the risk factors, it's fear, isn't it? It's fear that destroys our immune system and our capacity to think logically and rationally. And I think that's part of what's gotten into you know, gotten into this mess because we are so drummed up in fear that we lose the ability to think logically, critically. So I am forever grateful to you, Marilyn, and I want people to know about you and your work, your website. I encourage people to go to Marilyn's website because she has lots of great information and blogs and op-ed pieces from people. It's Marilyn Singleton, MDJD.com. So Marilyn Singleton, MDJD.com. And her Twitter handle is MSingletonMDJD. Marilyn, thank you so much for your time, for this mission you are on to speak the truth and help all of us get the real story and wake up to the truth. So thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your wisdom with us.
And thank you. It was my pleasure. I wish we had 10 hours.
Well, we have found you now. People can go learn more, sign up to your website, and share this truth, and share this truth. That's our work right now, is to get this message out to people so we can assist more and more people to wake up to their power. So, again, thank you, Marilyn, for everything you do. Stay well. God bless. And to all of you listening, thank you for joining me for another important and transforming conversation into our world, into our life. And remember to always honor the wisdom of our feminine self. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You've been listening to What Women Must Know with my guest today, Dr. Marilyn Singleton. And I'll see you again next week. Bye for now.